Well met, friends. I'm Steph Midlock.
And I'm Jude Vase.
Welcome to Medieval Thirstrebeth. Just kidding, it's Atherbeth, a podcast exploring the objects of literary lust of the High Middle Ages. Normally, the Atherbeth podcast explores the lesser trod paths of Tolkien's legendarium. However, today's episode completes our thoughts on the Green Knight poem and film. We'll be back on our usual Tolkien jam next month.
Hi, Steph.
Hi, Jude. I was holding back laughter.
This feels weirdly familiar.
You know what? Here's the thing. Boy, I need to start off with a huge apology.
Oh, boy.
Because guess what? I lost my audio for... This is actually the second time that Jude and I have recorded this bloody episode. And I lost my audio the first time. I just decided to fuck right off. And now I'm forced to come back here. I've forced Jude to revisit the Green Knight one more freaking time.
That's okay.
So I don't know. I just love Dev Patel so much.
Yeah, no, I know you did it on purpose so that we could talk about Dev Patel again. You didn't have to pretend to delete your audio, but I applaud your dedication to the bit. So
I am so sorry. And I'm sorry to our listeners. We really pride ourselves on being on time and always giving you guys new stuff. And so I'm sorry that I effed it up for us. But don't worry, now you're going to get all of our lukewarm takes on the Green Knight film. By A24. But first, let's see. What do we have to talk? How are you doing, Jude? You doing all right?
Yeah. It's been, a week. We're dog sitting tonight, so you may hear dogs in the background. And my son went back to school, which, I hate. I love my kid and I want him to be educated. But also, my county of Ohio is resting comfortably at 56% vaccinated. So
Oy.
Fuck off if you're one of those people that is not vaccinated and you could be.
Yeah.
The only reason there's even a mask mandate in his school district is because the parents all raised a fucking ruckus and the superintendent instated a mask mandate for his school district because the parents demanded it. Otherwise, there would not have been one. So.
Jeez.
Yeah. So that blows. It's frustrating for me because we're back at like March, April levels of infection, and yet people are like, whatever, I don't give a fuck. Maybe I got the shot. Maybe I didn't. You don't know, but I'm not wearing a mask. And I'm just like, fuck, just fuck right off into the sun. Delta is
really frustrating.
Spreading super fast, and we only have like cursory understanding of how it's affecting kids. And maybe it's more damaging to kids. Maybe it's not. Maybe it just spreads faster. We don't know. But
Yeah. Maybe
you should mask up, you fucking cretins. And you should absolutely all have the vaccine so that my kid can go to school and I cannot have a panic attack every time I drop him off. I would love that.
Yeah. I mean, this country is incredibly privileged in that we all have the ability to get the vaccine if we will. But so many people choose not to. It's absolutely ridiculous where there's so many countries where they can't have it yet. And that just sucks so much. And I'm sorry for that. And I please get vaccinated. Come on, guys. Let's not do this anymore. Let's get through this and be done. Right. Let's close the chapter.
Yeah, it's a subject of an enormous frustration for me as a parent, because it is terrifying in a way that I simply cannot describe to have no control over the safety of your kid in that way. I could keep him home, but he's already weird. And if he spends another year only being exposed to me and my wife, he's going to be a goddamn mutant. Like, he's already so weird. I can't deny him another whole year of socialization. You know what I mean? He's basically only seen us and faces on screens for the last 18 months. Like, we're getting into the point of like dubious developmental choices. So he's got to see other people. And this first week has really like confirmed that, because he's had such a good time. And it's been very obvious that this is the right choice. But that's going to depend on him not getting sick. So,
little angel.
To bring it back around to our original point, get vaccinated, wear a mask, make smart decisions, not just for yourself, but for the other people in your community that cannot get vaccinated yet.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. Anyway, what have you been doing this weekend?
Yeah, so I have been attending Oxenmoot, the gathering of the Tolkien Society that happens once a year in Oxford, but they've done a sort of hybrid one this year where some of it is in Oxford, but then you can also tune in online. So here I am in California going to Oxenmoot, and it's been amazing so far. This is my first one, and I've been loving it. I've been, you sort of have to get up at all hours of the night because things are, so like I got up at like 3:45 this morning, and then again, at 5 something, and then, you know, and I've been doing that for days, so I feel a little weird, I'm not gonna lie to you. Woo, it's a lot of Tolkien, but it is great. I've been able to like put so many faces to like Twitter handles and these wonderful folks that we've engaged with over the years through Athrobeth, and I've got to see them give these wonderful papers, and boy, it makes me very excited. I'm not gonna lie to you, I have a tab open on my For Signum University's
nice.
Certificate program. I don't know if I'm going to do it yet, but boy, I'm very interested in it.
I am so proud of you, considering I want to go back and get the audio clip of you saying when this all started, you saying that you would participate so long as you didn't have to read.
I said I wouldn't do any homework.
Yeah. And now,
yeah,
now look at you. I'm so proud.
It's really great. Aw, thanks. Well, it really is because of the foundation that you've given me. And I know that sounds like I'm just blowing smoke up your ass, but I mean it. Like all of these things, you know, these panelists and these papers that are being given this weekend are very smart and specific and using jargon that if I had not listened to this podcast, I would not know. Like they're like, oh, blah, blah, Akala Beth. I'm like, oh, I know what that is, kind of. Right? And yeah. So, and it's just really given me a new depth and appreciation for all this scholarship. So thank you for the past 3 years and hopefully many more.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you. Seriously, without you, I obviously wouldn't be here. I do want to point out, so one thing, important thing that I learned at Oxenmoot is the wonderful group Alliance of Arda that was started out of stuff that happened at Oxenmoot 2020. So they were functioning and then they had to back off because their chairs were students and still are students and the time commitment was too much. But they have come back again and they've got a Facebook group and a Discord, and it's a vibrant, wonderful community that still is very focused on their original mission of making Tolkien fandom and scholarship in these communities more open and celebrating more voices that have been historically downplayed over the years. I'm so glad that this group is still there. I didn't realize they were back. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so I don't know, maybe we can link to them. I'm not on Facebook personally, but if you are, you could find them there or through their Discord. And they're lovely and great. So I would suggest to all of our listeners to check them out because their work is so important.
Yeah.
So that's it. So anyway, I'm very excited. I'm all tired and I'm all tokened out and I like it. I feel good about it.
Nice.
I also have 700 microphones going, all recording, so there is no fucking way we are losing this audio today.
Nice.
So that's good. All right, well, we ready?
Yeah.
We've got many thick thews to tread, so let's begin.
Hey.
Hey! Woo! Well, as we said, this is actually our second time recording this material. And in the original Lost episode 38, we were going to like recap all this Sir Gawain stuff. But instead of that, you know, we last week or so, we put out a redux of episode 22. So we're going to skip all that recap. There's no need to keep recapping. What we're really here to do today is to talk about the A24 film that dropped digitally and in theaters, what, a month ago now? A couple weeks ago. Boy, yeah. I should have looked up that date. What was the date? Can we look it up?
What even is time?
All right. So after looking it up, it was theatrically released in the United States on July 30th, 2021. And we are now in September. So yeah, about like a month ago, a little over a month ago.
Yeah.
So that's why we did have hot takes and now we have lukewarm takes. But Jude,
they're well-marinated takes though.
Yeah. Yeah, well marinated. Thank you. I just rewatched the film last night, so I've now seen it twice. What about you?
I have rewatched it. I watched it a couple of nights ago.
Great.
I don't know that I necessarily watched it as closely as I wanted to. I think I need to watch it during the daytime.
Sure.
Because I think watching it like after a 10-hour day of work is not necessarily the optimal way to watch it, although it's very atmospheric. So it does put you in like a weird state of mind after watching it in that way. But I definitely think I want to sit down and like watch it during the day when I can focus and think about it.
I agree.
Watching it with having talked about it, I really appreciated some of the details, which we'll talk about here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very visually beautiful. And there are long like periods of like no dialogue, right? So yes, which is fine. But yes, I also found my mind because I'm so sleep addled due to this weird sleep schedule. I found myself getting very like loopy with it. Do you think, okay, first off, did you like the film? And did your like of it change at all between your first and second viewings?
I still love the film. It still, I think, probably is certainly one of my favorite films of the year. I think that when I first watched it, it was not at all what I was expecting. And which is surprising because, like, I've read the poem. Like, I have been as exposed as one could be to what it was going to be, and it still surprised me, which is a pretty good endorsement for a film. Because I had seen all the trailers. I had played the fucking RPG supplement, and I was pretty familiar with Sir Gawain and the Green Knight as a thing via Tolkien studies, and it still surprised me, which is bananas. There's not a lot of films out there that can surprise you like that. The second time, I was not as surprised, but I think that worked out well because I was able to sort of appreciate the sumptuous aesthetics of it more. That scene with the giants in the mist still freaked me out. Spoilers, by the way. We should put a spoiler warning on this. We intend to spoil the crap out of this film, but it came out a while ago, and I don't know why you wouldn't expect that. But anyway, But yeah, I think I definitely, because I was not constantly like testing my expectations against what I was seeing, I was able to appreciate some of the details a little more.
Yeah, I sort of had the opposite reaction. I really liked it when we first watched it, and then when I rewatched it, I found, because I knew what was coming, I sort of like focused more on what I wish was there.
Interesting.
Like, rather than, you know, because here's the thing, like the big spoiler alert is that this movie is nothing like the poem, right? Which is fine. That's fine. We knew that. It's an adaptation. It could be whatever it wants, right? But I found myself like, I think I found myself wanting more things out of the movie than it gave me, like the second time around. Mm-hmm. I found myself feeling a little bit like, I feel like it didn't serve itself all the time where maybe it could have. So, but we'll talk about that as we go.
Yeah.
But yeah, kind of interesting. But again, oh, a gorgeous movie. Absolutely beautiful. The music is weird and offsetting and totally bomb. Like the whole thing is very enjoyable. So yeah, I mean, I liked it. I just didn't love it as much as I thought I did the first time. So,
yeah.
Well, should we talk about some of the characters that kind of made this what it was?
Absolutely.
Let's start though by talking about like the use of names in the movie, because we, in the poem, you're introduced to a lot of characters, right? Even if they're only in for a second, we get a lot of name dropping, even a lot of like Arthur's knights are name dropped, but in the movie, not so much, right?
Yeah. Like Sir Gawain, even though it both is and is not Arthuriana, the poem. It is in so much as it is exists within the culture of Arthuriana. Gawain is a part of Arthur's court. Arthur is a character in it. There are lots of characters in it who are Arthurian, but otherwise nothing about it is Arthurian. It is a...
Oh, really? The 14th century poem. Okay.
Well, in the sense that like you could rename everybody in there and it would be a chivalric romance. There's nothing about it that adheres to this. There's no Excalibur, wet ladies handing over swords. Like nothing about it partakes of the Arthurian tropes other than the character names, right?
That's true. If you change the names, it wouldn't be an Arthur tale at all.
Yeah. And in that sense,
right?
I think it's very interesting to me that the film makes the choice to name as few people as possible. Even right. though the director is very clear that, like, the king is Arthur, mm-hmm. Gawain's mother is Morgan Le Fay. In his mind, he knows who these people are. But I think it's a really interesting choice to not name them. And so not to invoke that Arthurian tradition and to have the story itself stand on its own.
That's really, yeah, I'm so glad you said that. I didn't even think about that that's maybe what he was doing, but downplaying your expectations of an Arthur tale
yeah.
by removing some of these names, right? You're right, because the names that we get Gawain, we get his like sexy lady friend, Essel, we get Winifred, who we'll talk about later, but we don't really get, yeah, the Arthurian names.
Yeah.
It's interesting. That's very, ooh, good point. Ooh, see now, in the last episode, I don't think you made that point. So good.
Yeah.
Aha.
And I do think it's intentional because I think if you say his mother is Morgan Le Fay, that sets a whole bunch of expectations around her intentions and who Gawain might be or what Gawain might be doing or all this stuff. Whereas not knowing who she is, or not knowing necessarily who she is and having it not stated, makes it so that you have to take her actions solely in the context of what she does in the film.
Yeah, that's great.
So.
That is so smart. Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk to you about Gawain as a main character. From the 14th century poem is about Sir Gawain, a chivalrous as fuck, very pious, living by the five joys of knighthood.
Yeah.
You know, straight-laced ass, boring square knight. And in the end, he fails, right? So he starts as this like amazing, you know, oh, everyone knows I'm so great, you know, I'm so chivalrous, blah, blah, blah. And then in the end, he fails and he goes back and is like, oh, I have to live knowing that I am just, a human like all others. This is a completely different Gawain that we're seeing in the movie, right? Can you tell me? Tell me about that.
We made this point at like the very end of our Lost episode, and I want to reiterate it here, that I think it's interesting that in the poem, Gawain's arc is he starts ultra chivalrous and his arc over the course of the poem is to be tested and tested and tested and break. And then at the end of the poem, he has to live with those consequences of failing to live up to his own chivalrous standards. He takes the sword, he takes the stick out of his butt and has to live with that.
Yep.
In the film, he is not chivalrous. He's fundamentally maybe an okay guy. He doesn't seem like he's a bad person. Yeah. He just seems immature.
Yeah.
And he's lazy. He's kind of a coward.
Oh, absolutely. He's a coward.
He's privileged. And over the course of the film, I think that it's not even so much that he learns that he has to be like chivalry. It's honor. And I think there's a really important difference there. The chivalric code that Gawain embodies in the poem at the beginning is not what sexy Gawain demonstrates at the end of the film. Instead, what he demonstrates is he has this vision of what his life will be like if he accepts the shame of denying his honor and what that life will be. And he says he'd rather live with the honor of upholding his word. I'm not 100% sure, but it seems to me that the vision, the version, so to speak, of chivalry that they're saying he has there at the end is more about finding the nobility in himself than adherence to a specific chivalric code, which I think is in a way doing what all Arthurian stuff does, which is over time, we look at all these Arthurian myths and they're always being updated for new mediums and for new contexts of the culture they're being updated in. And I don't think that having Gawain embrace chivalric ideals at the end or the beginning of the film would make him a sympathetic or even interesting protagonist. Goody two shoes, like super chivalric characters don't play these days. They have a reputation. That's not who we as an audience expect or find really compelling. What we want is growth.
I don't know. Well, yeah.
Because the thing about Gawain is he's already perfect. So all he can do is fail.
Yeah. poem Gawain. Yeah, it's true.
So he's got to grow. And the in that context, if he's if film Gawain has to grow, what's he got to grow into? And the chivalric code that poem Gawain stands for is not meaningful to us. So what honor, what nobility can film Gawain embrace that is meaningful to us? And that's living a life with integrity.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the film is doing that's fundamentally different, is that perhaps very correctly, Lowry recognizes that it's hard to empathize with a main character who, whether he starts out chivalrous and fucks up or starts out a fuck up and becomes chivalrous, chivalry is not a moral code that we as an audience can necessarily empathize with.
Right. It is a medieval knightly system, right?
Yeah.
That's what chivalry is. It's a set of moral, social, religious code that knights live by that kind of gives them their power in a way, right?
Yeah.
We talked about this in the original Gawain episode that, you know, a knight's word, a knight's like honor, all these spokes within the envelope of chivalry are everything to knights. And without those things, that's why you have these knightly characters. Like, if I give you my word, there's a lot behind that, right?
Yeah.
Because without it, you got nothing.
Which is interesting, for sure. And if you write a whole like fantasy novel about that, that works. In the scope of a 2-hour film,
right,
it's hard to provide the context to make that meaningful to an audience that doesn't necessarily understand what that is. You can say what's chivalry, and a lot of people will answer, but it doesn't mean that they'll connect with it as an audience. Mm-hmm. And I think making Gawain's central conflict about finding integrity and an internal nobility, especially when you have an actor as charismatic as Dev Patel, who can go from this weak, privileged butthole to someone who is very compellingly submits to what is probably death. I mean, it's open for interpretation what happens at the end, but Lowry makes it clear that he thinks it's death.
Right.
I think is a very compelling arc for a modern audience.
This is the exact problem that I have with the film, that we go through, we deal with Gawain failing at all of these trials, right? All the way through the film, he's this way. And then finally at the end, he finally is someone like, okay, he's made this change. And like, yeah, absolutely. Like, wow, that's great. And then nothing? Like, there's no payoff. It doesn't feel to me like it was for anything in the end, right? And so to me, like, it's such a letdown at the end that he just dies.
I think
the importance of the story is that Gawain walks away. Either way, Gawain walks away and has to live with the choices that he's made, right? And so this movie, Gawain, if he could have walked away, like, now I've had a reason why I've gone on this with him, because, okay, he's changed and now he's going to make something of his life, right? But there's just nothing. And that left me feeling very empty the second time I watched it. I felt very like, why did we go through this?
I think... Okay, so I will tell you, as a film viewer, I agree with you.
Okay.
But I think that from I will caveat this by saying I do not know if this is what Lowry intended or if he was being a pretentious filmmaker and being like, you know, I wanted them to think about it. Like, you know how filmmakers will do that? They'll take an unsatisfying ending and being like, it was intentional. I wanted you to think about it, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
I think that from my standpoint, I like the ending. I recognize that it can be unsatisfying. Like, philosophically, I really like it, because there's the idea of, if he finds honor with the expectation of reward, what does it mean?
Yeah. Ooh, that's a good point, because we see that in the Winifred scene.
Yeah. If he does all that and then is rewarded, it's no different from him not finding honor. Because he gets all the reward he could want by denying the Green Knight, I think.
Oh, right. Yes. Like that alternate timeline that we see, which he goes back and assumes a role of king, but is like always haunted by his decision, it seems.
Yeah. But I think that's part of what the vision is trying to tell you, is reward is not the point. The point is that he's found his honor in this moment. And it's not necessarily, like I said, I get it. It's narratively not very satisfying, because he's finally become a worthwhile character, and in that moment he dies. But I think from a spiritual standpoint, in the sense that if you were if this were written like a Pilgrim's Progress spiritual manual, this would mm-hmm. be a really like valid arc, because this is the point at which he says, I've submitted myself to judgment without any expectation of reward or justification. This is the right thing to do.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I'm glad you said that, because actually, okay, it redeems it a little bit in my eyes. You're right. Yeah, because there is a part where he asks, like, if I do a thing for you, what reward will I get? And the character, we'll talk about it later, but, you know, the character's like, nothing. Why would you ask me that? Fuck you, man.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I guess you're not. Yeah. He's not doing something for the reward of it. But I just feel like I.
No. And I'm grant.
I want him to.
Yeah.
Get of a chance. Yeah.
I grant you that it's not narratively satisfying.
Yeah.
Like from a filmmaking standpoint, it's a very indie film ending where it's like, nah, fuck you. You know. And I get that. Yeah. I get that it's not a satisfying ending, but I think that it.
Yeah.
That's why I've been telling everybody that'll fucking listen to me, go play the RPG, because the RPG makes the end of the film better, because the RPG explains what happens to him.
I mean, kind of, right?
For
those who don't know, A24 put out what do you want to talk about? So when Jude says RPG, he means a role play game. So like a tabletop Dungeons and Dragons-esque, not really, but, you know, a different system. But where you come together and you tell a story together through your actions and dice rolls and stuff.
Yeah.
So can you tell them about the A24 game?
Yeah. So the A24 game takes the format of like an original D&D Redbox adventure, where it's a short adventure. I mean, we've played it. You can play it in one night. It's got a couple of pre-generated characters, and you sit around and you play it. And one of the things that happens is it loosely follows the plot of the movie, not so close that it really spoils the movie, but it describes some of the things that happen in the movie. And most importantly, it talks about what happens at the end.
Yeah, and you make choices as you go. Yeah. You make the same choices that Gawain is faced with, right?
Yeah, and at the very end, there's a description. You get to the end, and there's... I've just pulled it up, so I'm looking at it. At the end, there's three possible outcomes to the RPG. You can end with dishonor. You can end with honor, and then there's two ways you can end with honor. One of them is kind of a compromise ending, and then one is the Dev Patel ending, we'll call it, where you succeed in all challenges, you kneel before the knight, and then are slain. And I'm just going to read it, because I think it really explains what my point here. You close your eyes and brace your body for the axe to decapitate you. Well done. The Green Knight traces a finger across your throat. Now off with thy head. You do not feel it. There is only blackness. Your head is gone. You are gone. However, you are not dead. Your body becomes one with the earth. You have chosen honor. The legend you made lives on. It is rooted deep in the ground. Each time your story is told, a sapling emerges from the earth. Time will let the sapling grow into a mighty tree. The tree's branches will be gnarled and look like bones, broken and healed 100 times. Its shadows will seem foreign to a passerby. Cold wind will blow through its branches. More sun will break through, feeding the damp earth around you. Your roots will burrow deeper. The green will blossom. More saplings will rise. More knights will go forth. You will grow.
Wow, I'm so glad you read that, Jude. Because so the last scene of the movie, so he gets his head cut off, right, or whatever, or like it goes to a hewn tree trunk. Like you were looking down upon the rings of a tree, and carved in the tree trunk is the Green Knight, right? This is the last scene of the movie. And as you look at it, mosses and greenery start to form on it. And that's exactly what that you just said is going when that tree was cut down, it lost its head, if you will.
Yeah.
But from it grows new life.
Yeah. And it should be noted that the RPG was developed in concert with the filmmakers. It was intended to be released at the same time as the film.
Gosh, do you wonder? So then do you think that by playing the RPG people would like better understand and better connect with the film?
I absolutely do. And that's why I've been telling people, I think the game to me really helps inform and understand what the point of the ending of the film is, which is it's not about the outcome.
Yeah.
It's not about what happens after. It's about the journey and then the decision when you get there. Like the winning the game is to get to the Green Knight and then let him kill you. That is like the objectively best ending that the game offers you.
It is. Wow. And oh man.
The description
this changed everything.
The description there of like becoming a part of the green, like becoming a part of the Green Knight cycle, that works really well with the atmosphere of the film. The one part of it I don't understand, and we can get into it, or maybe now's a good time to like transition into it, is his mother. I have given a lot of thought to it, and I don't entirely get what the hell his mom is doing.
I thought about this a lot too, and I think I know what.
All right.
I don't know. I don't know. Okay, so in the movie, Morgan Le Fay is his mother, right?
Yeah, that's per the director. It's never stated, but it's per the director, the Morgan Le Fay, as opposed to, I can't remember, Morgues, I think, is his mother in the original poem. But in the film, his mother is Morgan Le Fay. And the scene where she summons the Green Knight, and it's very explicit that she is summoning the Green Knight.
Right. She's doing it through like an incantation that she's writing in calligraphy on a piece of paper.
Yeah, which is then...
David Lowery pointed that out.
Yeah, which is then like presented. The Green Knight then shows up holding and presents it to the king. It's extremely clear that she's doing that. And it's not... What's not clear, though, is it her intention that her son get caught up in this, or is it intended that is she just trying to fuck with the king? Like, it's not clear what the goal there is, especially when you take into account the way that she then goes into like preparing her son for this journey. Like, to me, I would have wanted to make it a little more clear what that was.
Yeah.
'Cause it's a little unclear to me what her intentions were, and that makes that to me that muddies his ultimate end. Because if it seems like she tried to kill him that way, that seems weird. But if it seems like he was accidentally caught up in this and then finds this ultimately rewarding resolution, that's cool. That works.
I don't think it's either of those things. It's just in the poem, Morgan Le Fay, we find out at the very end, does this to kind of fuck with Arthur and Guinevere, right? And the knights, because she has a beef with them and Merlin. Fine. So then totally different in the movie, I think. So we know from David Lowery, the director, that this is a failure to launch type situation, that Gawain and he has said that this relationship between Gawain and his mother is very similar to that of David Lowery and his own mother, where he kind of stayed home, you know, lived at home a little too long, had a hard time kind of getting out of the nest, right?
Yeah.
So this, I think that this mother character is trying to push her son out of the nest and to take that step into like knighthood and manhood. I think that she intends for him to survive the beheading game and to come back, which is why she created the girdle, which is of course different than in the poem, right?
Yeah.
She sews that rune in even after in the movie Gawain loses the girdle, which I don't think she intended. It finds its way back to him, right? Through Bertilak's wife. And then at the end, though, right? Well, we'll talk about that. You just made a very obscene hand gesture in my web camera. Oh, my. Towards the end of the film. So the other thing, too, is that people think that the little fox is his mother, right? Coming along with him on this trip to kind of watch over him and guide him a little bit.
Yeah.
At the end, he's about to cross this river, and the fox stops him and speaks with the mother's voice a little bit in the end and is like, don't go at this point. And I think what's happening here is the mother intended for him to come back, like having survived all of these things, a changed man, right?
Yeah.
But by the time he's come to the river, he hasn't changed yet. She knows that he's not going to make it through this situation. So she all of a sudden, it was always her intent for him to come back, right?
Yeah, it makes sense.
He was supposed to survive. And she knows at that moment moment with the river, if he goes the way that he's been going, he's not going to survive. And so she's like, just go back. And she says, no one will know if you just come on back. I'll never tell your secret, man. Just come back and forget it. So she tries to stop him in the end. So I think that it was her intention to call the Green Knight for him specifically. And I think, but I do not think it was her intention to have him die. He was supposed to come back better than he was. I mean, what do you think about that?
I think that's a really good analysis of what happens. Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, again, it's up to for interpretation a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Because it's very clear that the fox does not see that last moment where he does make the right choice and become the man that she wants him to be, even if it's just for a second before it's all over for him. Yeah, the fox is an interesting thing. Again, that's all for the movie as well. There is a fox in the poem, but it's just something that's hunted. It's really not like a character, but it very much is a big presence.
Yeah.
Just like his mom. Well, I have a question for you. So in the poem, Morgan Le Fay is this old lady who hangs out with Bertilak's wife and Bertilak in this castle that Gawain comes to right before he goes to the Green Knight, right? And she's like, she's not really in the story, but she's kind of there as his presence. And in the movie, we have this like weird old lady. Do you think that weird old lady is supposed to be Morgan Le Fay too?
Yeah. Okay. Because in the film,
very creepy.
During the original ritual where she summons the Green Knight, his mother blindfolds herself in a very distinctive way.
And yeah, that's interesting.
And then the old woman in white is similarly blindfolded the whole time that we see her.
Right.
My interpretation of this is that she is intervening at the end, trying to get him to... She's basically like tinkering with the chain of events at the end, where she has come to Bertilak's castle. She brings, I don't know if Bertilak's lady is Essel or just she makes Bertilak's lady look like Essel because they're played by the same actress.
Right. So cool. I didn't realize
But
that.
I think that's intentional to make it imply that like to make her more appealing to him. He
oh, yeah.
makes her look like Essel or it is Essel oh, yeah. ensorcelled in some way.
Or it's like Essel. Can I just interject? Don't lose your train of thought. But like, remember Essel when he's leaving asks him like, I want to be your lady. Like why, you know, and he doesn't answer. Right. Yeah. And it's because we know that like, if he's a knight, he cannot have a lady who's like a sex worker. Right. Yeah. Like, even though that's what she wants of him. And so his mother has created this beautiful woman who is like got the attributes of Essel, but is a lady that could be an actual fitting mate to a knight, right? Like she's learned and she's beautiful and she's poised and well-read and blah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Keep going. Sorry. Keep going.
And then she's there in the background, like
the mom puttering around.
Yeah. The mom's there in the background, like maneuvering all of this, even in this weird, creepy temptation jerk-off scene.
Yeah. That's weird.
So I do believe that.
I wish I hadn't done that sound.
Very, sorry. Not inappropriate, but like, not appropriate, if you know what I mean.
No, it's not the right feeling at all. I'm so sorry. I apologize to everybody.
So, yeah, that's what I think. I do think it's her there. And I think the motifs of the visual motifs and the motivation all sort of line up there. So
that makes perfect sense. I mean, yeah, I think, okay, so we're kind of alluding to this like girdle thing. So Bertilak's wife like is trying to tempt Gawain and she gives him this girdle. This is the same girdle. We're like, wait, how did she get this girdle? It's literally the same girdle that his mother and her, I don't know, sisters
her
or
coven.
Attendants or whatever, her coven, oh, I love that, makes in the beginning, right? With the protection rune sewn into it. So Bertilak's wife is like, oh, take this thing. It'll like keep you safe, blah, blah, blah. Then she asks Gawain, like, do you want it? Do you want it? She's like tempting him, but also giving him a hand job at the same time.
Well, to be clear, let's talk about this scene.
Okay, let's unpack it.
They start out and they're talking, like, she's being very seductive and he's just like, nope, sorry, not into it. I'm a knight.
Right.
It wouldn't be appropriate. You're a lady. Your husband has been very cool to me. I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm fine. And then she asks him if he believes in the supernatural.
Yeah.
And in witchcraft.
Magic specifically.
In magic.
Yeah.
And then he springs you know, a hard on, and she starts getting handsy with him. And this was pointed out in one of the articles I read about the film, and I had not noticed that. But on the second watch, it's extremely clear that that's the point at which his interest goes from he goes from like protesting, like he's got his line, to all of a sudden being like, magic, you say? Zip. Like, not to get too Freudian about it, but like, look at his mom. Like, his mom is this dominating presence in his life, who is not just a witch, but like the witch.
Yeah.
Like, it makes sense that that would be like an arousing sort of motif for him in a Freudian way.
Sure, it's familiar to him.
Yeah, so then she jerks him off onto the girdle.
But here's the thing. So she jerks him off onto the girdle and then sort of like looks at him with this like disdain. And she says to him, you're no knight.
Yeah.
And leaves. And at this point, he's like, oh, I gotta go. And he runs the fuck out of there, right?
He turns and sees the old lady standing there watching. And then he runs out.
Watching, but with a blindfold. So kind of watching, kind of just listening creepily.
Yeah. I mean.
No, but I know what you mean. She is watching. Absolutely. Yeah. Man. Yeah. So, I mean, that whole scene is so uncomfortable. It's so uncomfortable. And it's supposed to be. That's the point.
Yeah. It's even worse on the second watching. The first time, it's at least a little bit.
We were very taken aback.
But the second time, you know what's coming. You know what's coming. No pun intended. and it's super uncomfortable.
It is. It's very well done in that. Yeah. And then also like, oh, you're going to have to wash that girdle, man. That's going to be crunch.
He never does, though.
I wish I also hadn't said that. Oh, Lord.
I want to talk about the witches. Since we're talking about Morgan Le Fay, I also want to talk about the witches. I love the visual motifs of the witches, the sort of unusual hairstyles that seems to be the like, here's a bunch of ladies. There's one, there's two, and here's one with like
canonical
Batwing Princess Leia hair. That's weird, you know?
Well, like, not for medieval times though, right?
I mean, I don't know, but I think it's...
It's different for the movie.
And you see all these ladies attending his mother during her ritual. And then throughout the film, you see them not just helping his mother in other places, but you see them in the lady's manor, in Bertilak's manor. There's one of them. And like, it's the way that you recognize these witches are out and about. And I think it's a really interesting, like the blindfolds, the hairstyles and the hair pieces, like it becomes a way of recognizing that his mother and her coven are in a scene and are affecting a scene, which I really like.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
They have great style too. Like just they fucking do. On point.
Oh my God. I know. They're like beautiful and like very like I don't know how to describe them, but it's like they're like you want, it's like Mean Girls. You want to be part of that, but you also like don't want to be part of it. It's awesome.
The whole ritual where they summon the Green Knight is fucking great.
Yes.
I like that it avoids the typical like horror depiction of witches. There's nothing gross or squicky about anything they do.
Yeah, there's no like Eye of Newt or like a cauldron of bubbling or like, oh, we're cutting the blood of a thing and doodly da. Yeah. No, that's not it.
Which could definitely have gone towards. Because like A24 has done some fucking aggressive horror in its day. That's not what this is. I really love the visual motifs. One thing I noted when I noted in the last time we recorded this, and Steph was cool enough to pull the specific term for me. The space where they have their ritual is a round space with what looks like bones of some kind in the dirt, and it's open in the air above. I'm gesturing helpfully, but you can't see that. this is what's referred to as a dachma, or a tower of silence in Zoroastrian tradition. It is a circular raised structure used for excarnation, that is the exposure of human dead bodies to the elements for decay or consumption by animals in order to avoid contamination of the soil by corpses. I don't know necessarily that that's what they were intending, but all of the motifs line up with it. And it has a very, it's immediately what it made me think of.
Yes, that's so evocative. Once you said that to me during the last episode, I can't stop thinking about it. That's amazing.
Especially since in the Zoroastrian tradition, it was where the practitioners of magic went, because that was one of the few places where they could go where they would not be followed. It was where they practiced magic.
You know, and what you just said about the point of doing that is to avert contamination of the soil with the corpses, right? Yeah. To keep them apart. But that is absolutely completely opposite to what the Green Knight is all about and what Bertilak's wife says about how, you know, our bodies turn green and are returned to the earth.
Yeah.
So it thwarts that. It's like, it's the polar opposite, which actually I think is kind of cool. Yeah. It's like, yeah, it puts that at a juxtaposition. Yeah.
I definitely think they're doing some stuff with that there. So I definitely don't, it could be unintentional, but it feels like it's not.
Yeah. I would like to think that it's not, that it is intentional.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Okay. So a character that is kind of new to the movie who is not really in the poem is Winifred. And during the last episode, I was very haughty and said, oh, she's not in the poem at all. But I actually take this back. There is one indirect nod to her in the original Sir Gawain poem. It's mentioned that right when Gawain leaves the court and is starting on his journey around, and he's walking all around, blah, blah, trying to find the Green Chapel, he passes by Holyhead, which is, this is a real location. It's in Wales. It's a natural spring. That's the spring of Saint Winifred, who was like a 7th century martyr or whatever. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's really there in the poem, I think, as a wayfinding device to, like, because people in the 14th century would have known that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like, oh, okay. It being like, it's for us being like, oh yeah, she went up to San Francisco and turned left, or, you know, or whatever it is. So that, but it is interesting that they took hold of that and they really created this interesting moment in the film. So can you talk to us a little bit about Winifred in the film?
I don't know. So I
can you
narratively, I think the point of the Winifred side journey is to show two things. One, it's the first since the Green Knight. It's to show that there's supernatural horse shit about, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Cause like there's ghosts and the axe shows up and like, it's a weird scene. The second is that Gawain is kind of a good dude in this scene. He shows up and does everything that's asked, and he's admittedly freaked out by it all, but doesn't let that prevent him from helping out this ghost. And I think the intention there is to show that even though he's kind of a craven baby, he's not a fundamentally bad guy. And I think that was...
But he does ask for reward before he does it. He says, what will you give me if I do this? And she's like, nothing. How? Or she doesn't say that. She says, how can you ask me that in this like really like affronted way?
Yeah.
Now he does still do it.
Yeah.
But I think this is to show that he's still being a craven baby, as you say.
See,
which is a great band name, by the way.
I think it's showing that he's like in development. He's not there.
Yeah.
But he, okay. I think it shows that it's showing his potential.
Yeah.
Because he does do this brave thing. Swims to the bottom of this lake that turns into blood, maybe. I don't know. Maybe there's just a red lamp down there. Who knows? He finds this skull and brings it in, and there's like, it's a creepy scene. And he does this for her and brings her head back. And it's a good move, you know?
It is. And he does receive a reward, which in my opinion, which is a piece of information, right? And the head tells him Bertilak is, the Green Knight is someone you know.
Yeah.
Did she mean it was his mom's conjuring? I don't know.
Yeah, it's an interesting scene. I don't know necessarily if that was all that the director intended with it, but I think that it does that well.
Yeah.
Especially because he looks like such a fucking joke after the scene with the bandits that, like, need to counterbalance that, you know?
Yes. Yeah. No, it's true. I think you're hitting the nail on the head about why I didn't like it as much. I feel like there's a lot in this movie. I feel like, okay, there is a very rich storytelling history here with Arthurian tales. Now, I know you've already said this isn't really an Arthurian tale, but I, as a moviegoer and a literature lover is someone who's, I'm looking for deeper meanings in everything. I want to know, like, you know, in a movie with very little dialogue, why are they talking about this one thing? Or like, why is this tree in this way? And I think that some of this stuff was just there to be creepy. And I think Winifred, I think you're right about showing him in transition, but I think like there's parts of the stuff that's just there to be creepy or to like create a mood. And that, again, I'm trying to pick things apart and I'm not coming up with anything, as you say, and it's bugging me.
I definitely think there are parts of this film that have a lot that are very heavy and have a lot of meaning, comma. And then there's a lot of it that it's just like, it just looks fucking cool. It just, it's there to build a mood. Like the Giants in the Mist serves no purpose in the film. I cannot find any reason why you put that in except to show that he's like, is he high on fucking mushrooms? I don't know. Is it, it doesn't advance the plot any. It doesn't serve to really show you anything about his character. It just gives me nightmares.
Can I actually interject? I think it does show us something about his character. Only because so he's like this amazingly crazy mythical thing is happening in front of him. These huge giants are walking across. And the only thing he can think of is like, hey, can I have a ride on y'all's shoulder to the other side of this valley? Like, he's still only thinking about himself.
That's, I mean, I guess that's true. But
alleviate his own burden.
I think mostly they just put it in there to be creepy.
I know. I agree. So that really freaked you out, right? You said
both times I've watched it, that scene has freaked me out.
Yeah.
I am not into that scene at all.
Oh,
it's not like, I don't know.
Really? I think it's cool. I want to know he when he asks for help, the giant like says something, but it's like, you can't really hear and you're not supposed to, but I want to know what they say.
Yeah.
I want to know. It's very creepy. It's very creepy. I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Meet Morp. I wanted to talk. Can I talk about the pentangle in?
Yeah, please.
So the pentangle.
Which I think it's very useful to mention because that's not a common, like a piece of imagery. So.
This is a really interesting thing. So, and I only learned this by doing the research for our first Gawain episode. But basically this, the pentangle, the five-pointed star is a very important symbol for Gawain in the poem, and it's also present in the movie if you know where to look for it. The pentangle is an ancient Christian symbol for the five wounds of Christ, and in Tolkien's foreword to his edition of The Green Knight, he says that it represents the never-ending and interconnected set of ideals that are important to Sir Gawain. So those are the kind of chivalric things we were talking about. So in the movie, so like in the book, it's like huge on his shield and it's like on his clothing and it's everywhere. In the movie, it's way underplayed and I like that. So we see it on King Arthur's like medallion that he wears around his neck. You also see it on in the bricks of the court. So like where the Green Knight, where that original game starts, you can see it there. And then it's actually on Sir Gawain's shield, but it's tiny and it's right in the very center of the shield instead of being sort of painted on the giant on the shield like it is in the poem. And I think it's important because one thing I said to my husband as we were watching the bandit scene where Gawain is taken over by these bandits and basically they like take all of his stuff. One of them, these are like kids, first of all. The bandits are not like grown people. They're small. Yeah. They basically step on his shield like with one kind of curb stomp and break it in half, which if you think about a shield for a knight would not be able to be curb stomped so easily, I would say. And I think that this might be a metaphor because the shield has got the pentacle on the front and then on the back has got this painting of the Virgin Mary, which is also the same as in the poem. And I think it's to show that like these chivalric things and like this piety that is supposed to be important for knights to keep them safe is Gawain doesn't have that, which is why the shield fails immediately.
That's a really great observation. I like that.
Cool. Yeah, thanks. I was really proud of myself for that. But yeah, it's I love iconography. I love looking for it. And I think I like that Tolkien liked it too and would have seen that immediately. Yeah, kind of cool. Do you want to talk a little bit about the color in the film? I mean, I don't think I know what it's about, but tell me, what do you think?
I think color's super important in this film. There's been a lot of discussion about it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if you are paying any attention at all to the discourse about the film, you've seen articles about the color palettes of the film. Green, like the film itself has a very sort of blue-gray palette, mm-hmm. and which serves as a nice background to the green of the Green Knight, and then the stark, this splash of like this mustard yellow of the stole that Gawain wears everywhere. And I think that's really interesting. Like, and then like the crimson that the lady wears, and the use of color is very intentional to sort of signal people's intentions and alignments and stuff. And then to take the answer the question from another angle, I think it's really interesting that so they cast Dev Patel as Gawain, and then for his mother, they cast another Indian actress, Sarita Chaudhry, against the king, who is Supes White, played by Sean Harris, and Guinevere, played by another white woman named Kate Dickey, I've never heard of.
She was in Game of Thrones, I think.
Cool. I just think it's interesting that in this film, which is largely a white cast, the witch and her son and Winifred are the people that are of color.
Yeah, the important characters, kind of, huh?
Yeah. Smarter people than me, no doubt, have done some interesting analysis on this. I'm not going to attempt to do so, but I think it's worth calling out that Gawain is cast as a man of color in this film, and he becomes king if in this vision. In the vision of the alternate future, Arthur names him his heir, and he becomes king, and it's noteworthy that there's no hint of that being weird. Like, racism is never a thing that, like, comes up in the film.
I like that, yeah. I think that it is important to say that there's no description of Gawain anywhere. It's not, I mean, okay, yeah. There are hand drawings in the original thing. But
you're like, not entirely true. That's not entirely true. There are some descriptions of Gawain.
No, not in the original text, though.
In the original text, it describes him as having it describes the thick thews of his thighs. And it says that when he belted his brand upon his buxom haunches.
The thick thews of his also, thighs. His comely
it also says that he was very comely.
Yeah.
So we
you
know
found
he
my
had
research. So sexy. Well,
we
okay.
know that he was hot and thick.
We know he was hot and thick. Hey, that's how we like him. Well, I guess my point is, though, is that there is no need to stick to any, you know, preconceived bullshit race for any of it, because they no. could be whatever you want. And that's the beauty of these tales.
Yeah.
Like,
and even if he was described
wonderful.
As white, I don't think there's any, I mean,
there's no need to stick to that, though. And
yeah.
It's great.
And I think I would be interested to hear, and I haven't seen in any of the interviews any commentary from Lowry why he cast the way he did. I would be interested to hear his reasoning for it, and I would be interested to hear how other people who are more thoughtful and more educated than I am on this stuff, what their thoughts were on having Gawain and Morgan Le Fay be cast that way. But I think it's interesting. And
it's great.
And I think anything that gives Dev Patel more roles is great, because I think he's fantastic in this. The film is largely carried by his charisma, and I think that is impressive. So
absolutely. I think that the gatekeeping that's gone on for so long, you know, within the Tolkien community too, on this kind of crap is changing now. And it just adds a layer of inclusivity and richness that can only bring good things. It's so great. I love it. And
yeah.
If Dev Patel wants to give me a telephone call, that would not go amiss. Although I don't think he will. No,
you never know.
He's super hot. He's soups hot. He is. He's super hot. Ooh, those comely queases.
On that note, I feel like we can't. I feel like that's just how we wrapped up this episode.
Okay, I do have one more surprise for you.
Okay.
Okay. I have done a quiz for you. Okay. So in the last episode, I did a Mad Libs for Jude, which was like kind of funny, but not great. I have now done a quiz. I looked online for a BuzzFeed quiz. Which Green Knight character are you? And guess what? That doesn't fucking exist, because I guess BuzzFeed got out of their own ass. So I have created my own. Would you like to take it? It is five questions long. Okay. Yeah. Question one. Here we go. This is going to tell you which Green Knight character are you. If you were to be described by others, you'd most likely be described as A, outstanding in your field, B, a bit shifty, they better leave you alone, C, a team player who always gets the job done, or D, an emotionally stunted and often horny boy to the max?
A.
A. Okay. Number two, your enemies are resentful of A, your physical prowess and your loyalty in the face of danger. B, your command of a room. You always take center stage. C, your ability to work hard, and achieve your goals. Or D, your ability to put the needs of others before your own.
C.
Okay. We're going C. Number three, which characteristic do you value the most in yourself? A, your ability to respond to your teammates and keep everyone on track. B, your playful nature and your willingness to stick your neck out for a good jape. C, your skills at reading the deepest wants and desires of everyone. D, your knowledge and mindfulness of your own self, both the good and the bad.
I guess D. I mean, I want to go with the word jape just as because it's a funny word, but I think D.
Okay.
I guess.
D, good. And number four, where is your dream place to vacation? A, anywhere your best friend wants to go, you'll take them there. B, you can't go wrong with a place both verdant and holy. C, a haunted castle somewhere on the moors. Or D, a drafty court full of unfun knights and aging relatives.
The haunted castle.
Obviously. Easy. The haunted castle.
Yeah, obviously the haunted castle.
Woo! And number five, last question. When given a gift, your first move is to A, try to eat it. B, play a game with it. C, return it for cash, baby. Or D, to come on it.
Wow.
We went hard on that last question, baby.
Yeah, I guess return it for cash, yeah, given those options.
Oh, Jude. So do you have any idea of who the four characters are that I've
Gawain, the Green Knight, I don't know beyond that. Those are obviously two of them.
Okay. So you scored 24 points. I knew you were gonna get this one. That's so funny. Okay, so I'm gonna read you who you got, and then I'm gonna read you the other ones because so you scored 24 points. You got Bertilak's wife. You're a cute...
Interesting.
Yeah, here's what you are. You're a cute and comely chum, bewitching all who look upon you with your many gifts, both tangible and metaphorical. Let's face it, you like them young, dumb, and full of cum.
I'm not at all comfortable with that description.
Okay. Do you want me to read you the other ones because I'm so proud of them?
Yes, please.
Okay. All right. If you got 1 through 7, you're Gringalot the horse. You're Gawain's horse and most faithful friend. You are obviously the best character in this weird story. Get out of here. You're too good for these people.
Yep.
All right. If you got 8 to 15 points, you were the Green Knight. Damn, you're a red hot plant zaddy with a weird sense of humor and a very specific beheading kink. Good for you. Rock on with your planty self and don't let anyone yuck your yum. Then you got the Bertilak's wife one. And then the last one is Sir Gawain. You are such a good egg. You live by a set of strict chivalric rules, and no one can make you break your courtly manners unless they're hot or you're going to die. Then all bets are off.
So I picked the one that was the worst.
Yeah, you did.
Fair enough.
All right.
So
Fair enough. That was my quiz. Do you think we should put it up anywhere in case our listeners want to take the quiz? No. We should kill...
I don't know how to answer that.
We should probably set this quiz off on a fiery boat into the horizon.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so, all right, let me just ask you, final thoughts. What is your favorite shot or moment from the film? What stuck with you?
The summoning of the Green Knight is my favorite part of the film. Awesome. I think it's visually compelling. I think it's creepy, especially the first time you see the movie. You don't really know what's going on. It's very intense.
Yep.
That's my favorite part of the film.
That's awesome. And so what do you think? Do you think that Tolkien would like this film adaptation?
No. No, not at all. Bless the professor, but he's not in a modernization. I think that There are any number of places where you can see Tolkien not interested, bordering on openly hostile to the idea of modernity. And like, I mean, like he was into like modern science and stuff like that, but he just wasn't interested in updating and modernizing things. It wasn't what he thought was interesting or cool. He thought Disney was like an abomination, and he really was a hobbit at heart in a lot of ways. And I think there are parts of the film he would have appreciated. The idea of thinking about Gawain's relationship with chivalry and honor in the context of a modern man, mm-hmm. I think he would have appreciated. But I don't think he would have appreciated the sort of modern cinematic elements of the film. And I don't think he would have appreciated seeing the guy get a heijo. So
I think you would have enjoyed the comely queases. I'm just kidding. Dude just made a face. You can't see it, but he liked it. He liked it deep down. Woo! Well, awesome. I think we have talked quite enough about The Green Knight Forever.
I love the film, but I think I'm done talking about it for a while.
Agreed. So. Dear God, let this fucking audio not be lost to the ages like this were set.
It's recorded like three places. It can't possibly be lost.
Well, again, thank you so much, Jude, for doing this again. I'm so sorry. I hope that never happens again because I've just felt terrible about it. Thank you for being so sweet about it and for making that amazing GIF. We got a lot of great feedback on that GIF on Instagram. You got to check it out. Yeah. It's very funny. but again, thank you for going over this with me again. And I hope that the listeners enjoyed it. Let us know what you thought of the movie. If you feel like it, hit us up on Twitter or Instagram or whatever. We want to hear your thoughts.
Indeed.
Yes. Cool. Well, thanks again.
The road may go ever on and on, but this episode is over.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. It helps increase our visibility. You can find us on the web at www.podcast.atherbeth.com. You can find the show on Twitter and Instagram at atherbeth_cast. Jude can be found at @eremiticjude, and I can be found at @the_north_4. The title music is Lord of the Devil Rings by Pony Music, courtesy of Pond 5. Additional music from soundstripe.com. Today's episode was produced by James Pearson. Thanks for listening! Okay.
The last time I was sitting here, I was doing my feet were marinating in a weird jelly.
What? What kind of jelly? What are you talking about? Ew.
Have you ever heard of baby feet peel?
No. Is that like a thing for your feet where they become like babies?
Yeah. It's like, yeah, you buy a package off Amazon and it comes with two plastic baggies full of slime and you put your feet in it for an hour. And then you rinse your feet off, and over the next week, all the skin on your feet peels off.
Ew!
And when it's done, your feet feel like smooth. I don't really care about the end result. I just like that it makes your feet peel like crazy.
That is gross. Don't you have carpeting where you are right now? How dare you put gloppy feet near carpeting?
Well, because they're in like a plastic bag. So you like tape up the bag, and then you put a sock over it, and you just let it marinate.
Okay, so you just have gloopy feet. So did you do that during our podcast or during another
podcast?
No,
during game. During game Friday night. Okay.
I mean, I feel like as a co-host, you should tell me if you have glop feet.
I do not have glop feet. Okay. Although the last time I did this, and I did peel off a giant chunk of foot skin while we were recording the last time I did this.
That is cursed. That was...
I know.
Oh, gross. Well, met, friends. No, I'm just